Broadcasting in HD radio at 88.9 FM, this is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, and KBDH San Ardo. Streaming live and podcasting at KUSP.org. Hey everybody, I'm Gary Shapiro, and it's time for From the Bookshelf.
What will be.
Doris Day made 39 movies in her career. She starred opposite Clark Gable, James Cagney, Cary Grant, James Stewart, Henry Fonda, and Jack Lemmon, to name a few of her co-stars. She appeared in dramas, thrillers, comedies, and of course, musicals. Doris Day was a recording star with over 30 albums and many million-selling singles. She starred in a television series and in specials. She was a physical comedian and a sex symbol, and at the same time, a wholesome girl next door. David Kaufman is my guest tonight, and he has written the definitive biography of Doris Day called Doris Day, The Untold Story of the Girl Next Door. David Kaufman, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, Gary, thanks so much for having me on. It's really great being here.
Well, let me ask you, first of all, is it just a coincidence that Doris Day has the reputation of the wholesome girl next door and that your book is published by Virgin Books? Is that a...
Well, that's a coincidence, yes. Her having that reputation is not a coincidence. It was very much a manufactured image by her third and most significant of four husbands, a man named Marty Melcher, who was her manager before he became her husband. And he very much manufactured that image.
Oscar Levant once said, "I knew Doris Day before she was a virgin." Now, but you're saying that the image of Doris Day was far removed from the real-life person.
There's no doubt about it. I think Doris herself very much felt that. And I think that that's one of the reasons that she stopped visiting the past. She stopped talking about the past. She kind of put doors down, barriers to her past when she retired, essentially 33 years ago. It's fascinating to me how throughout her life and career, Doris would tell one reporter on one day that she had no idea where that image of the girl next door came from. She would tell another reporter on another day that she had to continue to play those roles and only those roles because otherwise she was going to disappoint her fans. And she did not want to disappoint her fans. So on the one hand, she colluded in both creating and maintaining that image, and on the other hand, she seemed to be totally mystified by why she had that image.
Well, it's one of the frustrating things about Doris Day as an actress, and she is an excellent actress, a natural actress. I mean, from the moment you see her on screen, she becomes whatever character it is that she's playing. And despite what we've just said, I think there is, you know, in the 39 films that she made, there's a pretty wide-ranging range of characters, so to speak. But the most frustrating aspect is that in so many of her pictures, for instance, Pillow Talk or The Thrill of It All, Love Me or Leave Me, That Touch of Mink, she seems in the beginning of the picture to be asserting herself in a pre-feminist way in this male-dominated era. But in the end of the film, she always falls back into place as if to say she'd been wrong all along to want a career and to be treated with respect. In Pillow Talk, for instance, Rock Hudson is a cad throughout the entire picture. He's a liar, and he cheats on his best friend, and it's all, you know, nonstop.
Well, he also lies to her about
right.
who he really is.
He lies everything for the sole purpose of getting Doris in bed, and she knows it. She finds out about it, and yet in the end, she marries him because he asks her.
Well,
do you think this aspect of her screen character had a correlation in her real life?
That is an interesting question. I think it definitely has a correlation in her real life because she is a tireless, workaholic, working woman. But in retrospect, one of the things I learned is she really didn't want to be working. She basically was driven to work first by her mother, then by her the husband I mentioned earlier, Marty Melcher, who was her husband for almost 16 years, her manager for more, and then by her son, who inherited the role of being her manager. In fact, that was another interesting thing I learned in the course of researching this book, is that throughout their lives, Terry said that Doris was more like a sister than a mother to him, and Doris said that Terry was more like a brother than a son to him. And that's for a very good reason. That is because when he was born, Doris quickly went back on the road as a big band singer, and he was really raised by the same mother who raised Doris, and that was his grandmother, Alma. In fact, Terry, much later in life, would claim that he had only a single memory of his mother before he was 7 years old. And that's his story is quite a story, because this book begins before Terry is born, and it ends some years after he dies, tragically. And it is a tragic life. Doris Day's memoir, which she wrote with A.E. Hotchner, was published the very end of 75. I think it became available in December, but I think it actually bears a 1976 copyright date. When she wrote that book, she was looking back on her life, and it was such a full life, such a rich life, and her memories, like everyone's memories, were fallible. When I was researching this book I really began this book by interviewing Mitch Miller 8 years ago, but I didn't begin devoting day and night, as I referred to it before, until a little over 4 years ago. I live in New York. I made 7 lengthy trips to Los Angeles, not only to interview people who were still alive, who were involved with Doris, but also to do a lot of archival research. And at the risk of getting into too much detail, the single greatest discovery I made as Doris Day's biographer is something at the Margaret Herrick Library in Los Angeles. It's also known as the Academy's Library, the Academy Awards Library. They have in their special collection something called the Jane Ardmore Papers. And Jane Ardmore was a journalist who wrote for movie magazines, the big ones, and she became a good friend to Doris. Doris befriended her. She went over to her house to socialize with her, not just to be interviewed. But the point is she trusted Jane in a way I don't know of anybody else who she trusted who ever interviewed her, and she interviewed her well over a 10-12-year period. And because Doris and Marty knew that they were going to have final say over anything that Jane published, Doris felt even more unguarded. My real point being that while Jane was interviewing her, Doris shared with her her true feelings about the past, the present, and the future, more or less as they were occurring during her career. And I think that they are more valid for that reason than her memories in 1974 and 75. And in fact, the Jane Ardmore Papers not only include the published articles, they include all of her transcripts, all of her prepared questions, all of her working drafts. Doris wrote in the margins of some of those, and unpublished papers.
Anyway. So you were able to kind of pry into the mind of Doris as it was happening back in the past.
Exactly. I think that is the true memoir. And among the many people who I am grateful to for the help that I received in this book is just, there's so many people, and my acknowledgments are quite extensive, but among them are Jane Ardmore's heirs, who gave me permission to quote from all of those papers.
We're talking with David Kaufman, and his new book is called Doris Day, The Untold Story of the Girl Next Door. What about her? You mentioned Mitch Miller, and so I want to ask a little bit about her recording career, which was an important part of her life. She made, I don't know how many albums, about 40 albums at least.
There are over 600 extant recordings, and a number of her early albums, well, she made single recordings before she started making albums.
Right.
Her first albums are soundtracks, basically. There's collections of songs from musicals that which she was in for Warner Brothers in the early 50s.
Well, when she got to the point where she was recording as a vocalist in an era of the LP, how much How much of a role did she take in choosing her material or the arrangements, that kind of thing? Or was she just simply a pawn of Columbia Records?
It really varies from album to album. One of the things that Mitch Miller in particular was notorious for imposing so-called novelty songs on his singer, including Doris Day. And there are anecdotes in the book from a man who replaced Mitch Miller, another man I interviewed and befriended named James Harbert, who is alive and well, I'm pleased to say, in L.A. today, with his lovely wife, Rita. And Jim was Day's rehearsal pianist before he succeeded Mitch Miller. Doris and Marty brought him on board, got him a job at Columbia, and he became her A&R man. He made several albums with her in that capacity. He also got her to do one of her finest albums, which is the album she did with Andre Previn.
Duets, yes.
But to answer your question, in some cases she was very involved. She was very involved in helping to select the songs on what I consider one of her best albums, which is Day by Day. But in the earlier part of her recording career, Mitch Miller really did impose on her a lot of songs that she regretted. One of the major stories about her recording career is that Marty Melcher, who has been called everything from Marty the Moocher to Marty Belcher by different colleagues and other people in Hollywood, he was adamant that she would not record any song without their getting the publishing rights to the song, because he ran, as a side business, Arwen Music Publishing Company. And Mitch Miller was the first who really brought this to my attention by telling me that he brought to the attention of Doris a song that became one of her best hits. It's a really snappy tune called Everybody Loves a Lover. And Marty Melcher imposed his rule. She's not going to record this unless we can publish it. The songwriter, and I'm blanking now on who that person's name was, told Mitch Miller, well, why am I going to walk away? Why am I going to turn that over to Melcher? I want those rights. Doris, it's the only time, according to Mitch Miller, who was her recording supervisor for 10 years, the only time, according to him, that Doris defied Marty's wishes and recorded the song, even though they would not get to publish it. He told me another incredible anecdote which speaks to Melcher's cheapness, and that is that for the most part, Mitch Miller lived in New York. The Melchers lived in Beverly Hills after they moved there from Hollywood, but certainly throughout her recording career. And when they came once to New York, they went out to dinner with Mitch Miller, who picked up the bill, and even though he picked up the bill, Marty Melcher asked him if he could have the receipt as a tax deduction. And as Mitch Miller said to me, you can't make a story like that up.
Well, you know, in her movie, Love Me or Leave Me, she plays Ruth Etting, a popular singer who is indebted to a sort of a gangster played by James Cagney, who dominates her life for 2 hours on in the picture. And it's when I'm reading your book and hearing about her relationship with Marty Melcher, there's never any moment in which she falls in love with Marty Melcher and is swept off her feet. And it just seems like he insinuates himself into her life. He befriends her son. I mean, he was actually married to Patty Andrews of the Andrews Sisters and divorced Patty basically because she wasn't as strong a meal ticket as Doris?
Exactly. As soon as she was no longer the meal ticket that she had been, he made his moves on Doris. And according to some evidence I uncovered, it was not a pretty situation. The way he did it was by ousting his partner, Al Levy, from the Hollywood agency, getting him transferred to New York in order for him to be able to move in on Doris. And I even interviewed a woman who was working as a secretary for a music publisher at the time, and she told me an amazing story about how she once came out to the parking lot at the end of the day, and she saw Melcher making out in the back seat of his car with Doris, and he noticed her. So after that, he really had it in for her. And anyway, I won't go into further anecdotes, about that, but they are in the book.
And so there is, I mean, it does seem like the character that she plays as Ruth Etting in Love Me or Leave Me is a lot like what happened to her in real life.
A lot. And she herself was even conscious of that. My memory is that she even makes a reference to it in her memoir. But so much of what she came to admit or acknowledge about Melcher was after the fact.
Yeah.
During the entire time of their marriage, they played a charade. In the same way that she was the girl next door, he was the perfect ideal husband, and it was the perfect ideal marriage when it couldn't have been further from the truth. Everybody that I spoke to who either worked with them or knew them acknowledged that their relationship was more of a business association than it was a marriage. However, there were a number of people that I spoke to who also liked Marty Melcher. And that was eye-opening to me because he doesn't have a reputation for being likable to anyone. But apparently he did have his funny side. And there, I guess it had to do with different periods. And there were times when he was happier than not. And I guess it's true of everybody. Everybody has more than one side.
I suppose if you write a biography of anybody, it's possible to color them in a variety of ways. But let me ask you about Doris's film career. I mean, she made so many great films, and she starred opposite so many great stars, as I was saying earlier. And she worked with Hitchcock and some of the other great directors. Michael Curtiz discovered her. He's the director of Casablanca, we all remember.
To mention the adventures of Robin Hood, Mildred Pierce. I mean, talk about variety.
Yeah, he was great. So why is Doris not as highly regarded as some of her contemporaries?
That's not an easy question to answer because there isn't a single answer for it. When you're talking about somebody who is, to this day, the number one female box office of all time. I mean, she holds that record because she's the only one who was number one 4 years in a row. And I don't think that anybody will ever be able to match that because once the studio system was gone, nothing is in place to make that possible.
Not only that, but nowadays an actress might make one or two pictures in 4 years, whereas in her 4 years she made a dozen.
Well, it's not only the number that she made, it's that she made she was number one for four different pictures 4 years in a row.
Mm-hmm.
That's the record that she holds. It's not true of Elizabeth Taylor never matched that. Garbo never matched that. Audrey Hepburn, nobody ever had that record. Well, I'll tell you, there is one female who did, and that was Shirley Temple. But she was, after all, a little girl.
A little child.
It was a different era.
Well, Doris Day was never honored with an Oscar or even a special Oscar.
She was nominated only once, and that was for Pillow Talk. There were many who, to this day, feel that it was criminal that she wasn't even nominated for Love Me or Leave Me. And at the time that she was not nominated for Midnight Lace, there was also a good deal of outrage in the columns.
So do you think that part of it could have to do with this thing we were talking about earlier where the sort of anti-feminist that she turns out to be in the end of every picture?
No, I don't think it's that, Gary, so much as what I really think it is that unfortunately the last five or six pictures that she made are not very good films. They're in fact pretty bad movies. And unfortunately that's where her career ends. Instead of changing with the times, we're talking about the mid-1960s. The whole world was changing. The culture was changing. America was suddenly entering the fray, making some exciting so-called art films, films that were to be taken seriously. And in fact, not a lot of people know this, but Doris Day was offered the part of Mrs. Robinson by Mike Nichols. And if she had taken that role, it would have, I think, taken her film career into a whole other level. But there was no way Melcher would let her take that role on. She's, after all, a predator, the opposite of the image that he had worked so hard to create and then maintain.
She was going to be, I guess the plan was to reunite her with Ronald Reagan for The Graduate.
Well, the plan was, although I think Ronald Reagan was not going to be Mr. Robinson, but was going to be Ben's father.
Oh, I see.
But he would have been in the film. Mike Nichols, according to certain things I've read, did want Ronald Reagan in the film as well. He also wanted Candace Bergen and Robert Redford.
It would have been quite a different movie then.
Exactly. It would have. So, but getting back to something you said earlier,
yeah.
In contrast with her image as the girl next door, if you really look at all 39 of her pictures, the variety throughout her career is astonishing. She has a film noir film early in her career called Julie, which very few people know, with Louis Jourdan, a black and white film, in which she does not sing a song except for the theme song, which is not repeated during the film. Midnight Lace, of course, is a straight dramatic role. The Man Who Knew Too Much, one of her most outstanding performances, and certainly Hitchcock, the finest single director she worked with. So the variety is there. And, as you said, she is so natural that even in the bad movies she makes at the end of her career, she herself is still wonderful. It was Michael Curtiz who told her in the beginning, shortly after he put her under contract at Warner Brothers in 1947, he learned, because she had never acted before, that she wanted to take acting lessons from the acting coach, and he forbid it. He had told Ingrid Bergman the same thing, that is, that what you have is so much larger than what is there on the screen, and he knew that if they took acting lessons, it would make them self-conscious. And they would lose it.
Lose that natural ability.
And in Doris's case, it usually is exhibited as exuberance, but also as vulnerability. It's incredible how, in The Pajama Game is one picture, and Love Me or Leave Me, it's another, where she really demonstrates the vulnerability and the strength in the same that the same character can have, almost at a flick of a finger.
We're talking with David Kaufman, and his book is called Doris Day, The Untold Story of the Girl Next Door, and the book has been very well reviewed. Congratulations.
Thank you.
But has Doris Day responded to the book? Has she seen the book?
No. I intended to send her a copy of the book, but I knew when I set out to do this project that even if I would get to talk to Doris Day, I knew that I would not be able to talk to her about the past, because I knew that she put that door down. On the other hand, it was, I guess it's now over 3 years ago, that Liz Smith devoted her column to my book, declaring it the definitive biography. And because of that, the floodgates open. And a lot of people who had known Doris and worked with her, they started to come to me. And Doris knew about my book since then. And she did nothing to tell them not to talk to me, and she did nothing to put up any barriers. So I received that as much of a sanction as I would ever get from her. And I did write her a letter, which she did not respond to. I've also called her several times without getting a response. My understanding is, excuse me, Gary, mm-hmm. My understanding is that when you call her, you have to get her at just the right time. If you do, she will talk to you. And in fact, I think if I called her at just the right time, even at this point in time, she would talk to me, but not about the past, about the dogs, about the present, about other people, whatever, but not about the past.
What is her life like now?
I think it's mostly about the animals, mostly about caring for the animals. My understanding, although this is maybe getting into too much privacy, her son died 3.5 years ago. That is in my book. But the man who sort of took control of everything, that man who had been a childhood friend of Terry's, I just learned yesterday that he just died 2 weeks ago. So I think right now she's probably undergoing a very hard time. She's not a young woman, It's a large estate. There are many things to tend to. But she does have a woman who comes by every day and looks after her. She has other people who are there at night and other people who are there on the estate. She has a large estate. The animals have their own compound on the estate, which includes its own kitchen. She doesn't have as many dogs as, at the high point, as one person told me who lived with her for several years, a number of years, and who was a big part of my book, at the high point she had 48 dogs. But what most people don't understand is that they're not exactly pets. She has been running an animal hospital basically since the mid-1970s. As people learned about her love of animals and her taking care of animals, they would come by her house on North Crescent and tie up their sick and wounded dogs, which they no longer wanted to take care of, to her gate. And the staff would bring them into the house during the day. And that was one of the primary reasons she had to move to Carmel, was because there was a city ordinance that she couldn't have more than three. She had 12 for a while before she moved. And she constantly was spending her days trying to farm out these sick animals to friends and to other people that she knew who, to take care of them. Certain people would run the other way. There are many stories. She once went on Merv Griffin and presented him with the dog. I interviewed Merv Griffin, and he told me this great story, how she showed up with the dog. She didn't tell him she was bringing it. And because everybody sees him leave the studio, he had no choice to take it home with him. And the dog ruined the bathroom, ruined his car, but they ended up becoming the best of friends.
Well, before we end, I do want to ask you about Rock Hudson. It turned out that he was gay and that he had AIDS and was dying. And Doris Day stood by his side. What was that like?
Well, in fact, the moment that she discovered how ill he was the moment when the media discovered it and had seen him for the first time in some months. And I don't think she knew that moment that he had AIDS. She did offer for him to come and live with her in Carmel, where she had been living already for 5 years at that point. This is 1985, because she thought that she could nurse him back to health. I think that they had a genuine love, certainly affection for each other. And I think, and this is a big theory in my book, I don't know that it was conscious on their part, but I think it's because they both, when they started working together, he was number one male, she was number one female. And consciously or not, they realized that underneath it all, they were both essentially the opposite to what their images were. And what better epitomizes Hollywood? Hollywood was always about image, and always about manufactured image, and always about the dreams that everybody else in the world had. I don't think it's just coincidence that Doris does not refer to herself as Doris. I don't think it's just coincidence that Doris and Rock called each other by other names. The two most popular, he called her Eunice, she called him Ernie. But they had other nicknames for each other. They did not relate to being Doris Day and Rock Hudson. They knew that they were not.
Did Doris know that Rock Hudson was gay?
I don't know for a fact that she ever told that to anybody. It's not the sort of thing she ever would have said to anybody. And I do know of some people who referred to people being gay, and she would say, well, we don't have to talk about that. But if she did not know, I would be shocked, because pretty much all of Hollywood knew. Just about everybody in the business knew. I can't imagine that she didn't know. I mean, not because he seemed it, but because everybody knew. She certainly knew that that Ross Hunter was gay, the man who brought them together, and she certainly knew that Ross Hunter and Rock Hudson were very close. There goes that alliteration again.
It's hard. Mitch Miller, Marty Melcher, Rock Hudson. Hey, the book is called Doris Day, The Untold Story of the Girl Next Door. It's a fascinating book. It's quite in-depth. It's about 600 pages, and it's written by my guest, David Kaufman. David, thank you so much for spending some time with us tonight.
Oh, Gary, thank you so much for having me on. I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the questions. Thank you.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program. I'll be back again next week with another great show. And until then, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org. As always, thanks go to our From the Bookshelf staff, Ms. Breanne Beal. Thanks, Breanne. For KUSP, I'm Gary Shapiro. Good night, everybody.